As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Welcome to the Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcozzi, and this week I'm joined by Paddy Barkley, Alison Rudd, and from the lovely northern hamlet of Rippenden, it's Oliver Kay. Today we'll be focusing on the FA Cup semi-finals, and I'll also be asking, what happens next to Arsenal? And I guarantee you, we'll have an answer in less than 102 minutes. So please join us for 40 minutes or so of the best and most serious football conversation you'll hear all week. Guess what, Paddy? No Premier League review this week because it's all about the FA Cup semi-final. Let's just get this out of the way because we haven't addressed it enough times in the past. Anybody want to defend the decision to have the two semi-finals at Wembley?
No.
No, I don't think we should have semi-finals at Wembley. Unfortunately, in the real world, the cost of Wembley, rebuilding Wembley meant that we have to. I mean, I think it's a matter of time before the quarterfinals arrive there. I'm afraid we have to in the real world. If we want Wembley, we have to play FA Cup semi-finals there. Ferguson for once in his life made a statesman-like point when he talked about the amount of petrol wasted in ferrying supporters to Wembley Stadium. Very good point, because in my opinion the National Stadium should have been built in the centre of the nation, somewhere near Coventry, and that would have saved the country and the fans a huge amount of money on balance. I worked it out once that it's something like 45,000-50,000 gallons of petrol are wasted per big occasion because of the siting of, I mean, by the people who aren't able to squeeze onto the trains, and that's an issue that should have been addressed 10 years ago.
That train comment was a joke, although we do encourage everybody.
It was a good one.
Yeah, but God doesn't want them to be played, the semi-finals we played at Wembley. That's why he closed the M1. I mean, there are signs. It's wrong.
I thought we could have a little mini debate at Wembley and somebody would stick up for Wembley. I'm assuming you won't be sticking up for Wembley, despite the fact that all these people coming down from up north had their day out and spent money, which stimulates the economy and so on, and all this, the duty on the petrol then goes to the exchequer and helps pay for nurses and policemen and doctors and parliamentary inquiries. You're still not going to stick up for Wembley, right?
Well, the only thing I would say in its favour is that you looked at the crowd at the Man City Man United game, and it was, 85,000, yes, something like that. And if it had been at Villa Park, which is some people's favourite choice, or at Leeds or at Anfield or somewhere up north, it would have been half of that crowd. And I'm sure a lot of Man United fans who were there wish they hadn't been, but I'm sure every Manchester City fan is glad that they went to Wembley, and every Stoke fan is glad that they went to Wembley, and the fact that they'll be there again next month is it's not really going to take the shine off it. But yeah. I did hear on Twitter from a Bolton fan who said his bus hadn't turned up to Wembley, or his bus had broken down, that he got a flat tire on the North Circuit on his way back to Wembley and after a 5-0 defeat, that sounded pretty grim. But let's be honest, it's these things happen, don't they?
Talking about the games itself, Ollie mentioned City fans there. They made an incredible racket on the day. I think some people wrote that this was their cup final, obviously, because it's a derby and it's Manchester United.
That's exactly why it's wrong, though. They won't get as many fans there for the final. So you're in danger of having the semi-finals up as for an occasion upstaging the final. That can't be right.
Everyone talks about allocation for the final.
You don't get as... FA Cup final tickets, the allocation goes to BODs, suits, FA bodies all around the country. Much fewer fans will be able to go to support their team at the final. So the semi-final becomes the beautiful day out. Everyone says you've got to be careful that we don't let the FA Cup become a nothing tournament, maintain its romance, how special it is. By having the semi-finals at Wembley, you undermine it completely, because what you saw at the semi-final was lovely. The fans were loud and there were lots of them, and the lovely boundary of colour was fantastic. It seemed to be mainly fans in the stadium, and you won't get that at the final.
So let's move on to the actual match. I thought Manchester United, I thought Berbatov had put away that chance, and by the way, I can kind of see, even when he plays well, why Sir Alex doesn't like to start him. I thought they could have won this game. I thought it could have changed the game. But you have to give City credit for coming back, right, Paddy?
Yeah, very good goalkeeping early on by Hart. A lot of people thought it was a missed chance by Berbatov, and there was an element of that. Manchester United could have been out of sight after 20 minutes, but they weren't. The better team went on to win. The reason for Manchester United's fade out, it was perturbing, especially as they've got a 90% chance of playing in the Champions League final on the same pitch. And I hope we're going to talk about the Wembley pitch.
90% chance? How do you figure that?
They beat Schalke,
isn't it a 50-50 chance?
No, it's not a 50-50 chance. I mean, Schalke win fewer than 50% of their games in the Bundesliga. So there's no team in the Bundesliga that's better than Manchester United. So, obviously, they have a negligible chance of beating Manchester United. But I hope we'll talk about the Wembley pitch, because the Wembley pitch could have a profound influence on the rest of the season, and indeed could deny Barcelona the Champions League title.
How so?
Because it's a pitch. You remember long ball football, you remember Cambridge, you remember, you know, all that kind of stuff. What do they do? They slow the pitch. They overwater the pitch, particularly in the corners, so that the wingers, so you can hit long balls for the wide players, who can then hoist it. That's exactly how Stoke played on Saturday. The wingers were the stars. I mean, the quality was unbelievable. It was an absolute joy to watch. But if the pitch hadn't been so slow, they wouldn't have been able to do it to such success. And my worry is that Barcelona won't be able to play their normal game on that pitch, because it's gone back. It played nice and briskly for the Birmingham City Arsenal, but it was back in its bad old ways over the two semi-finals.
I genuinely don't get that, Paddy. That through ball from Pennant to...
Okay, we'll be getting to Stoke, so maybe we'll...
It's the same pitch. We're talking about an angle of ball.
We're talking about Manchester City and Manchester United, and if you talk about Jermaine Pennant, why don't you make up a different example using a different winger? That through ball to Adam Johnson, for example.
Well, yeah, the through ball of the semi-final was the one in the Stoke game. Okay, but I genuinely, Paddy, did not see in either semi-final an incident that made me think that pitch is rubbish.
Well, I'm telling you, it was there, and I mean it would be very, very difficult for Barcelona to play their football effectively on that pitch.
Let's all trust in the UEFA gods that they will make sure that we will have standard pitches, and that they'll stop this weird English habit of watering the pitch at all and liking to play on a wedge pitch, which I think is kind of weird and just sort of rather creepy, actually. We're talking about the pitch. We even managed to mention Jermaine Pennant and Stoke fans. We will get to you. Paddy, Yaya Touré earlier this year, we got all this, oh, look, another defensive midfielder, and he's making a scandalous amount of money. Although, if you actually talk to people at City, they'll tell you that that figure that gets bandied around is some kind of misrepresentation, blah, blah, blah. But people say he's slow, he's lumbering, he's indolent, blah, blah, blah. I want to put this to you. It just be that he actually has a really unusual body type, unusual combination of skills.
It's not unusual because it's all through the family. You look at Kolo Touré, who's
Kolo Touré is like a foot shorter than he is.
But the point I'm trying to make is versatility. Both of them can play in any position on the field. Kolo Touré was a distinguished midfield player even before he came to Arsenal and established himself as one of the top centre halves, footballing centre halves in the country. Yaya is exactly the same. You noticed it in the Champions League final 2009 when they had an injury crisis at the back, just switched him from holding mid to central defender, won the game, kept did they keep a clean sheet? I can't remember. Anyway, and brought in Busquets in his role, won the game. So both the Touré's are remarkably versatile. They, as Jockstein once, somebody once said to Jockstein, what's Kenny's best position? Kenny Dalglish, is he an attacking midfield player or a striker? He said, oh, just let him on the park. And I think the same is true of Kolo Touré. And I must say, we're talking about Yaya. And I must say that a 10 out of 10 to Mancini for realising that there was a way of stitching the midfield and the front together at Manchester City, which has been a problem, by using his drive. And yes, I think he was my man of the match, closely followed, of course, by Vincent Kompany.
Yeah, it helps if Michael Carrick gives you the ball. I mean,
he did more than just score the goal, right?
Stitching is one thing, but I think the key was if you get Man United making a huge error, that you capitalise at that very moment, which is what City did.
Ollie, in terms of Sir Alex's midfield, right, you've got one central midfielder giving the ball away and costing him a goal, the other one getting himself sent off, and I don't really want to reopen an eternal Scholes debate. I think enough people know how I feel about this one. I contrast Scholes with Ryan Giggs, who mysteriously wasn't there, and I look at who's contributed more to the team, who contributes more to the team regularly, and I think it's no contest. But should Fergie be a little bit worried or annoyed at this stage?
I think most people have looked at Manchester United's midfield over the last few seasons and said that the lack of real authority, not authority, but the lack of real physical presence in there is a problem. And Dan Fletcher has barely played, or has barely played well this season, and he gives them physical presence in a different way. And I mean, going into those games against Chelsea, they had Carrick and Giggs in central midfield, and it looked like a weakness against a powerful Chelsea team. But they did well over the two games, and Chelsea didn't really press home that advantage. But against City, from sort of 20 minutes onwards, I mean, United were overpowered in midfield, and Carrick and Scholes, I thought, offered very little. One was made a mistake, as you say. One was sent off in pretty crass fashion, and that is United's weakness. I'm sure they have other weaknesses as well, but that will always be their weakness. And sometimes they'll paper over the cracks there, and sometimes they won't.
Regular listeners have heard plenty of me and Patty and Ollie talking about Paul Scholes, but I just want to ask you, as a fellow member of that coloured hair fraternity, or sorority in this case, it's the age-old thing. People have so much respect for Scholes as a player, and then he does stuff like this, and nobody can understand it, and, inevitably the pundit or the commentator sort of, like, sort of giggles nervously and says, Scholes, he just never learned to tackle, ha, ha, ha. But obviously, he's 36. It's getting a little bit, it's wearing a little thin. I think that was the 10th red card of his career. Do you sympathise? When you played, did you learn how to tackle? Is it that difficult to learn how to tackle?
It's not difficult to learn not to do what he did on Saturday.
So did he do it because it was deliberate?
That's inexplicable. This is dangerous territory, saying that he wanted to gouge the thigh. And did you see the pictures of the thigh afterwards? It was pretty disgusting.
I think he was intending to hurt his knee, actually, which is even worse.
Yeah. I mean, that was probably the best case scenario, the gouge
foul
on the thigh,
yes,
wasn't
exactly
it?
So the gouge on the thigh would have been a lot nicer than what he was trying to do.
You could suggest, possibly, the game was running away from United. Scholes felt frustrated. It wouldn't have been a conscious thought. It would have been subconscious frustration. And if you're a combative player, that... and you are frustrated, you end up, especially if you're getting on in years, you end up doing something that's illegal because you're not doing the legal things well enough. I mean, Ferguson said it's, and managers will always let players off, if you like, by saying it's part of their character. If you have the beauty of the player and the energy of the player, you have to accept that occasionally you get the automatic downside. Obviously, it's not automatic. There are many, many feisty, excellent midfield players who don't resort to getting that many red cards in their career. So, I'm not going to say I think it was deliberate. It was just a subconscious act of being frustrated. And obviously, you know, for Scholes, you're not used to things running away from you. United are usually on top. You're normally on top. It's not a normal feeling. Big occasion running away from you.
Yeah, I mean, if Scholes is gone, that's not anybody else's fault. That's just the way it goes. And I just think it's so horrible. It was so horrible to see that. And it's not the first manifestation of what's going on in his mind and everybody else's. You know, he came on against Arsenal and, you know, he nearly crippled a couple of the Arsenal players, and he only came on in the 86th minute. He didn't have long to do it, but he squeezed it in. It's almost as if it's almost like a cry for help, and I think it should be answered. I don't think he should play again. I think it's too much of a risk.
Actually, Paddy, that brings me to my next question.
Yeah.
Wrapping up our Paul Scholes segment, you mentioned he shouldn't play again. One of the sadder things is seeing people as they get older, yeah, seeing their skills decline. You know, I'm hope that when my little girl grows old enough to, yeah, watch television, Paul Scholes still won't be playing, because, you know, if his skills decline or whatever, she'll, you know, she won't believe me when I tell her, yeah, he's actually once an outstanding footballer.
Even on Saturday, at the best part of the day.
Exactly.
Best part of the day.
If you're Sir Alex, do you give him? Did you keep him around another season?
No, not in a million years. Not as a footballer.
As a what?
I don't know. Ambassador, speech maker. I don't know, but definitely not as a footballer. I don't think there is any longer a milieu in which he can be useful without the risk. I mean, there's no point in playing him in the early rounds of the Carling Cup. That's for the young ones. I don't think there's any function for him. At the level at which Manchester United aspire to play, and indeed play, he's a liability now.
I agree with Paddy on Scholes' tackling. I think it's pretty outrageous that he's got to this stage of his career and still been allowed to get away with it by Alex Ferguson. But I do think if you look at some of his performances, certainly in the early part of the season, I think you can certainly see a case for at least offering him the chance to carry on playing for another season. If he costs 70 grand a week or something like that, 80 grand a week, which has probably been a steal for Manchester United over the years, then it's going to be a lot harder to replace that quality and that experience on that kind of budget. I mean, United don't generally tend to be blessed with money, at least not money to spend on their own terms. And I could see the case of Ferguson saying, look, play on if you want to. If you don't want to, then go with our blessings. But I mean, I don't think they should ever rush players like that into retirement, because we could have been having this debate about Scholes 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, because he committed these kind of challenges and often looked off the pace in those days. But then he would have a performance a few days later where he passed the ball 92 times and only gave it away once.
Yeah.
He is a fading force, but he still has something set.
I mean, it was always a trade-off. I remember back in when Keegan was the England manager, he had a performance, and we're saying it's ageing, but he wasn't ageing in 1999 when he committed three of the worst fouls you will ever see in a goalless draw against Sweden at Wembley. I mean, the Swedes still talk about it, and they're, you know, in fact, on Saturday he made history by becoming the first player to be sent off both at the old Wembley and the new, a record which will probably never be beaten. So I mean, it's been a long time. It's been too long, and I think it's past the joke now.
we're going to talk about the other semi-final. And as I read in Oliver Kay's excellent piece today, Stoke score 5 goals, and there's no set pieces, no yellow cards for them, all goes from open play. Alison, do you agree with Ollie Kay's assessment? And if you don't worry about it. I'm sure he's not listening. and also, how did this come about? I mean, is this really a change? Were Bolton that bad? Was it just a case of Stoke adapting to the situation?
Well, I've never quite understood where all the criticism of Stoke has ever come from. They've always been a team that mixed it up, I thought. It's just, I think that when they first came into the Premier League, there were an awful lot of analysis of their long throw technique,
maybe it's also playing centre backs at full backs. Maybe it's the way Tony Pulis talks and looks.
It stemmed entirely from the fact it gave
Shaw cross on Ramsey. No,
it gave the TV studios something to talk about. It was fun, and so you get a label straight away that you can only score from doing something slightly unfootball-y. And then everything you do is seen in a particular light. And I've only ever seen Stoke mix it up. Yes, often they've won a game because they've got a big man up for a corner or they've got a long throw. But for most of the 90 minutes, they have put together a variety of play that has seen them baffle opponents, which is why they've stayed in the Premier League. And I think I agree entirely with Ollie. I thought it was poetic justice, and it was really rather lovely that they won it without resorting to any of the things that any of their critics could point to as being anti-football.
Paddy, I don't think long balls and physical play are anti-football. I think they're part of football.
I love watching De Lapp's long throws. I wish they wouldn't let him have towels to.
I don't particularly enjoy the long throws, but I mean, I think Stoke did play a certain way. I think Stoke changed halfway through last season to some degree. I think that's when they started mixing it up a little bit. But I think to sort of start depicting Stoke as, you know, Brazil 1970, I think is a bit of a stretch.
No one's doing that, we're just saying.
The train is now approaching junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
They've always mixed it up. It shouldn't have been such a surprise that they could play nice football at Wembley.
Yes, and I think also, I mean, most people, if you really love football, you just as a cricket fan will love to see a spinner. A real football fan will like to see a winger. And we had a magnificent exposition of wing play yesterday from Stoke City on either side. It's very, very, very seldom that you see two wingers perform on the same day to the standard that Etherington and Pennant did, and I found that an absolute joy to watch.
Ollie, Etherington, I thought was outstanding. We put Pennant in the same category.
Yeah, Pennant was excellent. I mean, he's always had the ability. Pennant, I mean, he showed it in flashes at Birmingham, certainly, and less so. I mean, more sporadically at Liverpool, but his career gone into free fall a little bit, or at least he'd fallen off the radar a little bit when he moved to Spain, and that didn't really work out. But his performances since he went to Stoke have been excellent. And Edrington, as Paddy says, he's just been a fantastic signing for Stoke, and those two have transformed them into more of a footballing team. I mean, we were talking about direct football earlier and saying that often direct teams like to use wingers and like to hug the touchline and so on, but maybe that's the case. But if you look at the way they play, it is attractive that those two wide players and the goals that Stoke have scored over the years. I'm sure if you look at the first few months of their Premier League existence, a very large proportion of them were coming from Rory Delap long throws and from corners. I think a far larger proportion now come from the wing play of Pennant and Etherington.
Well, he simply wasn't playing two wingers until recently. I think there's no question there's a difference in style if you have two wingers. It's not like before Pennant got there was another Pennant type who wasn't as good. There was often Delap, actually, as the wide midfielder.
Yeah. I think we also have to be careful not to judge them on this, to go too far on this one performance. I mean, after all, they could easily be relegated. I mean, and they've lost five away games in a row in the Premier League, so they're not always as good as they were yesterday. But my word, they showed yesterday what they're capable of.
Looking at Alison, looking at Bolton, all season long we've been talking about Owen Coyle. He plays football the right way, and I look at this 11 he put out against Stoke, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Ollie, and you can maybe tell us how they actually lined up on the pitch. It was different from television, but I see one holding midfielder there in Fabrice Muamba. What kind of a weirdo formation is this?
Well, it was a sort of 4-4-2, kind of 4-1-3-2. It didn't work. I think.
But what was he trying to do?
I couldn't tell you.
You didn't think to ask him after the game.
I didn't. He was in the press conference for a short time. There were lots of questions to ask, but but Bolton are weaker without Stuart Holden in the area. I think he was one of the sort of unsung heroes of the Premier League for the first first part of the season, and they have missed him, and they've sort of experimented with various things over the past few weeks, and that they certainly missed his presence in there yesterday. I mean, Elmander is a technically very good footballer, and I've seen him play in a deeper role, certainly for Sweden, in the past, but he really didn't work yesterday.
I think Coyle made sort of more or less admitted afterwards that he'd sort of predicted Bolton's team, and personally I hate 4-1 What was it? 4-1-3-2 as a formation. I think it's ridiculous. And I saw England playing it the other day, which worried me greatly. But Coyle did pick a terrible side. And this is what Pulis used Walters for. He pushed Walters onto Muamba, took him out of the game, and there was just nothing left. So we're able to run through Bolton for the rest of the game.
And if Bolton don't have Holden and they don't have
Holden's so important,
and they don't have Sturridge either, who's the key player for Bolton? It's Kevin Davis. Who did Tony Pulis say they focused on? Kevin Davis. Okay, if you can stop him. Winning those flick-ons, you've stopped most of.
I don't think so,
threat.
Actually, at all. With this Kevin Davis, I mean, from what I've seen, I think in Elmander, you know, I saw Pulis say that on television. I think, I don't know if Pulis really thinks that, but I mean, I think the threat in a game like this could have been a guy like C.Y. Lee or Elmander, you know, as much, because obviously if I'm sending Kevin Davis, I know he's wonderful in the air, but if I'm sending him against Shawcross and Huth, you know, I know it's going to be tough for him all day. And that's why you can maybe get a mismatch with Elmander. You can send Chung Yung Lee running at players. I mean, I think this, with hindsight, I think Coyle's sitting there saying, you know, they were very good, we were awful, but I made all these mistakes that made us worse. And I think, you know, evidence of this is the fact that at halftime, you know, he took off Petrov, who, you know, is a nice idea, but does no work defensively, and Klasnic, and replaced them with Mark Davies and Matty Taylor, you know, two sort of more traditional players to try to tighten up in midfield a little bit when they were three goals down. But he had no choice because otherwise, it could have been almost a cricket score.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm surprised Blake didn't start. But the other person you talked about, Lee, and I've never seen Lee so quiet ever. I think we talked about who were good for Stoke, and we forgot Mark Wilson, who was superb at left back, I thought.
That's another central midfielder.
Yeah, but he doesn't look. He's a footballer, Wilson. You know, he can play holding mid. He can play fullback. He's an excellent footballer.
He's sort of like, you know, the British Isles' answer to Yaya Toure in some ways. No, I mean in the sense that he's tall and looks a little awkward, but
yeah, he's certainly
good. He's skillful on the ball.
He's certainly versatile and he's skillful on the ball. Yeah.
Now, let's talk a little bit about Silent Stan Kroenke in our debate. Wednesday night, Arsenal have a big derby against Spurs. Spurs are pushing for the top four. And of course, at the weekend, there was this bizarre game against Liverpool, or a game with a bizarre epilogue. I want to check it back to Stan Kroenke. By now, foreign ownership isn't really news. We're used to Kroenke being here because he's been an Arsenal shareholder for a while now. Mm-hmm. But Ollie, I wanted to start with you. We tend to treat about sort of we tend to treat sort of especially American owners as sort of being all the same, but they're actually different. From what you've read, what do you make of this guy compared to, say, Warner and Henry, who are there on your doorstep?
I think it's hard to know what to make of him, full stop, really. And even judging by his record and reputation in America, it's hard to say with any certainty that he will have the same approach in England to a football club. I mean, I think George Gillette in particular was talking when he bought Liverpool, or he and Hicks bought Liverpool, as if he was some kind of benevolent, benign uncle type figure. I genuinely think he said at one stage, in a few months' time, you'll be calling me Uncle George, and I doubt even his nephews and nieces call him Uncle George. Owning a Premier League football club changes people. It doesn't necessarily make people show off their best side, or sometimes it makes people show a benevolent side that they don't normally have. But I don't know. I wouldn't judge him based on his track record. I would judge him on what he does over the next 3, 4, 5 years and beyond, because there's a lot of people who've come to England with reputations as great businessmen and great custodians who have proved to be otherwise when it's come down to them.
Yeah, Ollie, your Uncle George analogy is apposite, because a spokesman for the Arsenal Supporters Trust said that Kroenke had looked him in the eye and said, "I don't want to change the way Arsene Wenger runs this club. I like the way things are. I'm not going to interfere." And "I believed him" was the outcome of that. But this is before he starts his campaign to own the club. And as you say, as soon as if you do get control, or enough control, that then you judge why they did it in the first place. It's very hard to believe that someone wants to make a move to gain ownership and not have a vision that's different to the one that exists.
Although, to be fair, in this case, we're talking about, you know, a rarest of rarities, a club that's already very well run, a club that's profitable. You know, it's kind of almost like a turnkey operation. You don't really need to touch it, as long if you think the profits are going to continue rolling in. And I think with Kroenke, that's kind of the sense that we got in the past. I mean, the guy's in the sports entertainment business. You know, he uses his real estate company to go and buy a plot of land. He uses his construction company to go and build a sporting arena. He buys, whether it's a hockey team or a basketball team or a football club, and he buys them and gets them to play in the arena. If he can find another team in another sport that can also is also compatible with the arena, he sticks them in the arena as well. He owns a ticketing company that sells tickets to the arena. He owns the TV network on which those games are shown. I mean, if slavery were still allowed in the U.S. or if he had an apparel company, he would be fully vertically integrated. I mean, Patty, is he going to buy Harlequins and get them to play at the Emirates to help, you know, consolidate or to help maximize revenues?
I don't know the details of his plans, but I do know that broadly the Americans now sense soccer in Europe is going to be as profitable as sports in the United States and as easy to run. At the moment, it's an absolute bed of nails, as Alison and Ollie have pointed out, a destroyer of reputations. I think it'll be much more easily to become a avuncular or a messiah in European football under financial fair play. I think that's going to make a crucial difference. The Fenway, John Henry of the Fenway Sports Group, made that very, very clear when he took over Liverpool. He said, without financial fair play, we wouldn't be here. I think that will make a great difference. And I do agree. I think there's no club, apart with the possible exception of Manchester United, better placed in England to just simply reap the benefits of financial fair play than Arsenal. I think it's a complete no-brainer. I think he's going to make a lot of money. I regret that people make money out of football, but there we go.
Ollie, in light of what Patty said, that, you know, it's going to be an easy way to make money out of football and so on, and the reason I'm asking you is also because I suspect that I already know what Patty's going to say. In Germany, they famously have a rule where no individual owner can control more than 49% of a club's shares, effectively meaning that clubs are generally not, I mean, they are for-profit entities, but generally that they're clubs, and they have a diffuse shareholding and so on, and, you know, no wealthy zillionaire would ever really want to buy a German club for that reason. Is that a healthier, more stable, long-term model, considering that also, you know, Patty said before that U.S. sports are profitable, but, you know, the NBA lost collectively something like $720 million over the last 2 years and is heading for a lockout. The NFL is in a lockout right now. The owners want the players to give up more money and so on, take pay cuts, and that's with a salary cap and all that jazz.
Well, just going by what we've heard from Arsenal over the past few years, I mean, I've spoken to Ivan Gazidis on a number of occasions where he has said that the previous model at Arsenal, where there were multiple investors, i.e. Kroenke with his share and Usmanov with his share and the late Danny Fisman and Lady Nina, etc., where they all had their stakes sort of across the board, he was making the case that that was the perfect ownership model. That was healthy. That was stable. And I'm sure Ivan will be keen to talk up the positives of the new situation. Just like we saw David Gill change tack on his debt is the road to ruin. Quote regarding the Glazers, but we just don't know. No, I don't think Kroenke is going to be able to buy the entire club, because Usmanov doesn't seem like he will accept the offer for his shareholding. So maybe that will be a sort of check and balance. Maybe that will be a sort of blocking stake.
He's not going to be on the board. He's not on the board now. I mean, he's just going to sit there with his 28% stake or however much he owns, and that'll be that.
Well,
right?
But maybe he can wail in the background, and maybe he can do this and that. And maybe that is healthy. Maybe it isn't. But it's I don't think there is any sort of one model that will work for every club or that we can say is disastrous. I think different things work, different things don't work, but more often than not, it depends on the individuals and what their approach is going to be, whether they're prepared to invest or whether they're determined to borrow against the club.
But the other thing is, Usmanov came out and offered to dilute his shares by selling some of them to the Arsenal Supporters Trust if Kroenke agreed to do the same in an equal proportion. And Kroenke said no. Alison, should we be reconsidering Usmanov?
Well, it seems a jolly decent thing to do, doesn't it? Well, it depends on your motive, doesn't it? What we haven't mentioned, and it probably sounds naive to do so, and yet it's crucial, is how much of passion and love do the people with the money in the club have for the club? Often diverse ownership, all it means is that no decisions are made, and therefore managers stay longer. Managers who stay longer often perform better. So by default, you get a divided ownership results in good management because they don't have that sort of, totalitarian, I'm in charge, I do what I want. The extreme example being Chelsea, where there's nobody monitoring what comes out at the top at Chelsea. It's just one man with power who stamps all over the club. So
you could be describing Manchester United there, and they've been pretty successful.
But they came after the model.
The man at their club is a football club rather than a business.
I was joking. How about some quick hits? Gareth Bale wins the PFA award. Paddy, I think this is the stupidest, most meaningless major award in English football. Am I wrong? And who would you voted for if you were a professional footballer who doesn't really enjoy watching football on television and prefers spending his time in the company of young ladies and plenty of alcohol, and yet you still had a PFA rep on your team who nagged you to return your ballot in early February because presumably there is no internet access at whatever club you play for's training ground, and the only way that you could send it back to Gordon Taylor is by Royal Mail.
No, you're not wrong, Gab. I mean, vote in February. I mean, it would make sense if it were the calendar year, but obviously not for the season. Yes, and the answer is I would have voted at that time for Charlie Adam, and I would now be sort of thinking, well, I wasted my vote. They all did.
Why do they vote in February? Have you ever asked them?
No, I haven't.
Didier Drogba has a monster game as Chelsea come from behind to win at West Brom. Ollie, if you were Ancelotti, given his situation, would you just start Drogba ahead of Torres the rest of the season? And given that Chelsea are now just 2 points behind Arsenal, can they actually finish second?
Can they actually finish second? Of course they can. They're only 2 points behind, as you say, and Arsenal looking unconvincing. So, I mean, second place is up for grabs between those two clubs, and Manchester City, even Tottenham wouldn't give up on it at this stage. But Ancelotti dilemma, I mean, Drogba ahead of Torres, that was a thing to do before now. Now that they've probably got less to play for, maybe now is the time to be looking to integrate Torres in slightly less high-pressure situations. But there shouldn't be a dogmatic decision either way.
Kenny Dalglish has been chucking kids into the first team, first Flanagan, then Robinson, without forgetting Spearing, and John Joe Shelby as well, who's not a local kid, but nevertheless still a teenager. Alison, is Kenny just trying to figure out which of these guys is good enough for Anfield, or do they actually have a future at the club?
Well, Kenny played them because he had no choice, but they did remarkably well. Flanagan survives a debut at Anfield against Manchester City, and then, as Kenny pointed out, it's probably harder to play a second game for the club. And he wasn't perfect, but he did a grand job at the Emirates. Robinson had played 2 or 3 minutes at Hull, and then gets his proper debut again away from home, a team going for the title. If you can't draw conclusions from just one or two matches, but if you felt you had to draw conclusions, then they definitely have a future.
Anyway, Gab, one for you. Part one of the current Clásico extravaganza finished in a 1-1 draw between Real Madrid and Barcelona at the Bernabeu. Part two is in Valencia on Wednesday night with the Copa del Rey final. What did you make of that one on Saturday night, and what can we expect on Wednesday?
And should it have been at Wembley?
Actually, that's an excellent point. Wembley should just be rented out for these sorts of games. I mean, why Valencia? I'm sure everybody would fancy the trip here. I think Mourinho went with an approach which he himself would probably find as overcautious. There's no need to play that way. It is Barcelona, but you're Real Madrid. You should play to your strengths. And not coincidentally, after they had a man sent off and went and goal down, I thought they dominated large spells of the second half, which is positive. I think we're going to see a very different Real Madrid in the Copa del Rey final. I'm just not sure it's going to be enough to beat Barcelona. You can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find all your news, your gossip, your analysis. My web chat is on Mondays. Patty's is on
Tuesday.
And I believe Ollie K is on Wednesday. So you can join us for all of those. You can follow us on Twitter. We're all on there. We all love Twitter. We're tweetaholics, especially Allison, whose Twitter handle is?
I don't know.
There you go. Look her up. It's all we got time for today. So till next week. Bye-bye.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.